first episode of the season here on the Dunked On Basketball NBA podcast, but our joy was really stolen not 5 minutes into that first game with this terrible Gordon Hayward injury. It is a dislocated ankle and a fractured tibia for Hayward. I was amazed that he was as conscious and lucid as he seemed. I mean, it was just an absolutely gruesome injury. I was lucky enough to not actually see what happened like right away. And he obviously went down, and you could tell from the reaction of the players on the floor that, I mean, the last time I saw players react like that was that Paul George injury in 2014.
It was horrible. I saw it live. You could tell because we were in the media room who saw it and who didn't, because it just took the life out of you. It was so tough. And Hayward, you know, was such a key part of why the Celtics were exciting this season. And we don't know how long. I don't want to speculate on the timetable here, but it was bad. It looked bad. And this is a fundamentally different team for however long it is that they're without it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think people have talked about it. Jeff Stotts was saying, you know, probably out for the year. David Chow was saying, you know, 8 to 12 months. So I really, I heard that elsewhere also. So I would be extremely surprised if he were able to come back. I mean, this is not the same injury that Paul George had. In fact, it might be a worse one, frankly, with the ankle dislocation. But George, you remember that happened in August and he returned. Wasn't the same player as well, but did return for a few games at the end of that season. I mean, that was about an 8 month recovery for him. So really, I mean, if he's not back by the start of the playoffs, you'd think it would be a huge surprise they brought him back during the playoffs. So I think it's pretty safe to assume that he's going to be out for the year. The good news is that in a lot of ways, fractures are better. And we saw this with George, then ligament injuries, right? Like bones heal. So I think the real issue as far as his career, I don't think anyone is saying that this is going to be career ending, which is good. But the real issue with his career is going to be that ankle dislocation and whether he's able to come back from that. But I mean, at this point, I think it's looking like just massive consequences for the Celtics this year, and they're gonna have to find a way now to go on without Gordon Hayward. And we apologize for the, it almost seems in some ways insensitive to go on and discuss what their team is gonna look like, but you know, I mean, that's kind of what we have to do here in our jobs. And so what is this gonna mean for their season, Danny?
Hayward was so capable last year taking on initiation with the Jazz as George Hill went in and out of the lineup. I was very impressed with the way that he shouldered that burden, and it was such a natural fit with Kyrie Irving because Irving has played with that type of guy for the most successful years of his career. And there is no other player on the Celtics at a position other than point guard who can really do that. So they're going to be in a different role, you know, probably a lot more Marcus Smart. And something that we saw in the first half of this game, and full credit to them for really rebounding in that second half, playing with it, and we'll talk about that later on. But what we saw in that first half, I think we'll see a fair amount in the future, which is decent shots created, but for guys that are not the best at shooting those. And so then that makes them kind of a make or miss team. And it's going to be a lot about whether Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, Jason Tatum can hit their open threes. That's a challenge for them. It's a very different value proposition than having Gordon Hayward's foundation there. And also, he had proven to be a much better defender over the last couple of years, and they will miss him on that end as well.
Yeah, they will. Marcus Morris, when he comes back, is another guy who there's going to be a lot of pressure on him. He's got a little bit better pedigree as a shooter than those guys you mentioned. But yeah, I expect them to still generate a lot of three-pointers. I am not sure that they are going to make a lot of three-pointers this year. We could see them miss quite a few of those. And for the Celtics, I mean, you have to wonder, you know, I had them at 50 wins before this. You have to wonder now if there's going to reach a tipping point without Hayward where they just don't have enough guys who really know how to play, especially offensively. And we saw tonight how important Al Horford was to them as really that one guy who can facilitate everything at the elbows. Hayward is probably really the only other guy who's an above average passer for his position. Maybe Smart is starting to get there a little bit, but I think just as a glue guy who would move the ball, who had played in a motion heavy system, a guy who is not really as committed to getting their own offense, or someone who's young, like a Tatum or a Jaylen Brown who's trying to establish their own career, maybe ahead of where the team is. I think they are really, really going to miss him, especially defensively as well. I think he could have done a much better job down the stretch. He didn't start on LeBron, but I think he could have guarded him much better down the stretch than Jaylen Brown did in this game. And so you have to wonder, I mean, if we thought of them as a 50-win team with Hayward, what does this mean for them now? I mean, are they going to be, I mean, I think they'll still pretty clearly make the playoffs. They have enough talent to do that. And maybe these rookies will really come through, but they're going to really be relying on those guys now. And you have to think, you know, 45 wins, low 40s, like that might be where they're going to end up this year, potentially.
My first thought was low 40s. They're going to miss Hayward a lot on both ends. And this also, as I harp on with almost every injury, it puts so much stress on the rest of the team to stay healthy, because now then you get into, if somebody else goes down, they're, you know, they have a lot of forwards, but they don't have a lot of, you know, creators and things like that. So I think low 40s is probably where I would be right now. And, you know, it's not as much of a focus on 2017-18 now as it would have been if they had not made the Kyrie Irving trade. You know, if Isaiah were going into free agency and everything else, this would be a very different conversation. But it still matters. I mean, there's still going to be players in so many other things, whether we're talking about big trades or just the Eastern Conference as we look forward to it. And something else we should mention just briefly is Bobby Marks put this together very well, and of course a tough circumstance, that the Celtics will be eligible to apply for the disabled player exception, which would be worth $8.4 million. They have until March 10th to use it, assuming they get it, which they will. And they can sign, claim, or trade for somebody as long as they have exactly 1 year remaining on their contract.
Yeah, that $8.4 million equal to the mid-level exception and could be used until March 10th. They have to apply for that, but presumably they would be granted it. In some ways, they are a little bit better positioned to weather this than a lot of these teams that we've seen lose great threes, because most teams, you know, three is such a rare position in the NBA that most teams just, you know, don't have any kind of backup. I mean, at least they can look at the fact that they're not going to be having to play any replacement level guys. Hopefully, maybe Semi Ojeleye will have to play a little bit more, though. Once Marcus Morris comes back, I don't think they even necessarily will need him. They can play some more two guard lineups with Irving and Rozier. They can extend Smart's minutes more. Even someone like Abdel Nader maybe could give them some minutes. So I think they're going to be, maybe they can weather this a little bit better than some teams could, but I think they're going to reach this point where it's just too much inexperience, too much maybe, I don't want to say selfish play, but more individually focused offensive players. And especially, I think when Al Horford is out of the game, they're going to really, really struggle now, because Aron Baynes obviously is not that type of facilitator that keeps everything moving.
And now this is definitely the hardest coaching job, at least to Brad Stevens' NBA career, maybe even moving forward, because it's just the lack of continuity, it's just a lot of things changing. And maybe they can make it through it. Maybe they can go through it. And, you know, in the long term, getting some confidence in these young guys, because it looks like their team is going to stay together now for a little while. Maybe that works out for them. But I mean, it really did cast a shadow over the proceedings, as it should. You know, this was an important thing. It was a team that we were very excited about. But, you know, there was still a basketball game to be played. And as I said a little bit earlier, full credit to the Celtics for, after getting shell-shocked, you know, basically for the end of the first quarter, the rest of the first quarter, and to a point the second quarter, they really did fight back, and Cleveland gave them a little more ground than they should have.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they defended the Celtics very well in the first half. It was 54-38 at halftime. The Celtics only a 76 offensive rating in the first half. And Cleveland's offense didn't really look that good to me in the first half either, but Boston's offense really looked rough. Cleveland did go to more switching. That was something that Chris Fedor talked about was going to happen, that they're going to go to that scheme more. They did do that. Boston, without Hayward, was really unable to take advantage in large part until the second half, which we'll talk about. But we did see Jason Tatum have a nice debut. Jaylen Brown, career high 25 points, although he was 11 to 23 from the field. Definitely was able to create shots in Hayward's absence. So we're going to find out whether these guys are good or not. And Jason Tatum in particular, I mean, he might become a little bit more of a favorite for Rookie of the Year now. Probably still not going to get up enough shot attempts, but he's going to have all the playing time he can handle, especially if those two guys are starting. They're really going to be relied upon to create offense now for this team. And they'll have their chances in some ways, it could be good for Boston to develop them, also good for them to develop their trade value potentially, and good for those guys' careers as well. So, you know, there are opportunities that arise even when you see an injury like this. Why don't we shift to Cleveland here? Do you have some general observations about how they played?
Their transition and help defense was shaky last year. I mean, that was a big part of their undoing against the Warriors in the finals. They can survive that most of the time, but good Lord, were they bad in both of those capacities for a lot of this game. And it doesn't matter until the playoffs. Cleveland can coast along, but I was just a reminder, like, especially if they're going to play Derrick Rose and Dwayne Wade together, if they, you know, if they don't score on that possession, the other team's going to have a good shot at a bucket.
Well, the big thing that stuck out to me, yeah, their transition defense wasn't great. Their D was pretty good in the first half, and then they got killed by Marcus Smart in the third quarter. But I thought their bigger problem actually was not being able to score in the second half.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
And even in the first half, they only took 8 threes in the first half. 5 out of 22 for the game, and then they took a further 22 shots from mid-range, not a team that took a lot of those, and when they did, it was mostly Kyrie Irving, a great mid-range shooter, taking those shots. Now they don't really have anyone necessarily like that, and Wade and Rose, kind of what you would expect from them, only 4 three-point attempts. The only one that was made was a desperation heave at the end of the third by Rose, which actually ended up being the winning margin, the 102-99 victory for the Cavs. Wade only took 1 three-point attempt, and those guys combined for 8 out of 24 from the field and only got to the foul line 4 times. So if those guys can't get to the foul line and aren't going to make threes, it's very difficult for them to be efficient. And then you see those guys combining for 24 shots. LeBron had to play 41 minutes. An amazing game for him again. 12 of 19 from the field, 16 rebounds, 9 assists. But so few of his assists now are going to be threes, right? And then you saw when they went to J.R. Smith, they were kind of back to what they were previously. Smith, 22 minutes, 10 points, plus 7. Rose was minus 7 in his 31 minutes. And Wade was even in his 29 minutes, only had 8 points on 3 of 10. So everything I think that we said about this team, maybe they'll get a little bit more comfortable with each other. Rose, I mean, just watching him looked pretty spry, but he looked that way too last year. And he just, you know, he doesn't put the ball in the basket efficiently because he's not a great finisher around the rim, even though he gets there. So he's not efficient there. He's not getting the foul line, and he's not getting any assists, only 2 assists, and he's not hitting any threes. So he can create these impressive looking drives, but then you look down and he's 5 out of 14. So I really don't see. And then Kevin Love, who's by far more efficient than Rose or Wade, 9 field goal attempts. That's not great either. It's definitely a concern for me about how this offense is going to look. And it's going to be, LeBron was really the only guy who was able to create an efficient offense other than JR.
LeBron was awesome in this game. And as you said, the changes in their offense are going to be so fascinating because of the composition of the shots. Is just, it has to change. And Love playing center, you know, a larger portion of the time. Tristan Thompson only played 19 and a half minutes in this game. How they balance all of that is going to be, it's going to be a challenge the whole year. Like, figuring out their rotations is going to be hard, and then they're going to have to do it again. They're going to have to do it at least twice in this season just because Isaiah coming back and everything else. And it's more...
They need him, though, I think.
Oh, man. They need him so badly.
They either need him or they need to start J.R. Smith. You know, and they close this, you know, and we'll get down the stretch to what happened there, but they closed this game with Rose and Wade in the backcourt, and it really, you know, Boston wasn't quite dialed in. They have all these young guys, but then when they started not guarding Rose and Wade, they're really able to muck up a lot of the stuff that the Cavs were trying to do. And can you imagine if they didn't start Kevin Love and just park him out at the 3-point line, like how bad their spacing would be if they had Thompson out there too?
Yeah, and the challenge here also is dealing with guys that have big names and big egos. I mean, you're going to be dealing with, I mean, Rose going to the bench, that's not going to be a big deal because Isaiah is a way better player. But, you know, the Wade-J.R. Smith dynamic is going to be challenging this whole year. I mean, Wade is one of LeBron's best friends. He was brought onto the team for a reason. But I think J.R. Smith is a much better fit for what they're trying to do and what they need than Wade is. So how are they going to rectify that? How are they going to reconcile it? And yeah, if LeBron, you know, if he drops a ridiculous line like he did here, and then when we were worried about, you know, starting the year with that ankle issue, didn't didn't seem to rattle him too much here. But that's going to be just a challenge for them. Is can LeBron be that superhuman? How are they going to balance that? And this was 41 minutes in a October regular season game. If they're going to, at certain points, more often than in prior years, need him for that, it's still the regular season. They need him to have as much juice as possible for the playoffs, because that's all that matters to this team.
In fairness, he has made the point before, I think, that it's not so much the minutes as it is the games played, that it doesn't really, it's not that bad for him to play a few more minutes. But, you know, and obviously he played these many minutes last year and he was totally ready to go in the finals, had a wonderful finals and playoffs. So maybe he can keep up with it, but at his age, and by the way, I made the point on Twitter today that at Nate Duncan NBA, if by some miracle you don't follow me already, that he's playing at a level that really only one other 32-year-old has ever reached, and that's Michael Jordan. To still be playing at this level of, you know, a top three player in the game at this age. So that's really impressive. One thing that I did really want to talk about when we get back to Boston is we saw the most space principle in very, very fine form with the Cleveland coaching staff and players who had to deal with Kyrie's inability to defend or unwillingness to defend low these many years, just go right at him every single time.
Especially by just involving him in the primary action and knowing that it de facto forces a switch. And so a lot of times teams will use that to just take advantage with the point guard going on the big, but the best counter to that with Kyrie is actually to have the screener just post him up, because Kyrie folds like tissue paper, and Cleveland did that mercilessly throughout this game.
Yeah, LeBron was so locked in on that. If it was Love setting the screen, I mean, you say de facto switch, they're not necessarily supposed to switch, but any screen involving Kyrie just ends up being a switch because he's just going to not get over the screen. And then whether it was Crowder, whether it was Love, they just threw it into the post. He got a couple of fouls and then just was letting them do whatever they wanted. And there were some plays late too where he didn't help out in a back screen, gave up an alley-oop on that one. Let's see, what are some other observations that we had here? Dwayne Wade did have a couple of nasty blocks. He got Tatum once late to set off fast breaks. Those were pretty impressive to see him bring it at least down the end as an element, as the greatest shot blocking guard of all time.
I thought
it was interesting to see. Yeah, go ahead.
I thought Terry Rozier looked pretty good, you know, more comfortable than in prior years. I still think he's a straight backup. I don't really like him playing with Kyrie that much at this point. But if he can fill that role, that might be more necessary now if Marcus Smart is one of the guys who they consider to move into the starting five.
Yeah, and they may do that. That'll help keep their defense at about the same level. I think Smart is obviously a great defensive player. Smart, for his part, had one of the worst halves I've ever seen him have in the first half. He was just trying to take every shot. A lot of stuff they were running, actually, when he and Kyrie were in the game, was running Kyrie off the ball, and Smart was probably a little too aggressive. You could see that they were unable to agree on that contract extension, which we'll talk about later in news. But whatever he was thinking he was going to get paid, he was definitely gunning to get all that in the first half. And then he was able to make some hay in the second half, just posting. I mean, he was posting up Kyle Korver, who has 4 inches on him. He was posting up JR, who has 3 inches on him, and just getting fouled and killing them. He was 4 for 5 in the third quarter after going 0 for 8, really got them back into the game, a third quarter in which they outscored Cleveland 33-18. I think I would have actually had Smart guarding LeBron late. Jaylen Brown was on him, and just Brown, for whatever reason, just cannot play strong. Like, he's got this really jacked body, but he just doesn't understand leverage. Like Jared Weiss and I were talking about that earlier this week on the Celtics preview, that he just does not play physically at all. And at least on defense, on offense, he'll post up and get good position, but on defense, he just does not know how to use his body. He doesn't play hard enough. And so LeBron was just going right through him every time he tried to post up. So I think I could have gone with Smart there instead.
Well, one of the stories that ties in with a story of this night, both games, was the virtue of strength relative to your size. Because in this game, Marcus Smart was able to do that on guys who are taller than he is, but, you know, he has the strength and the will to kind of push through them. And then I think that was true in the second game as well, with Eric Gordon at moments, Chris Paul at moments, PJ Tucker at moments, being able to maximize maximize that, and we do sometimes lose appreciation for it, because length is very valuable. I mean, you could see that all over the floor in both of these games, but players that know how to use their physical advantages are very, very dangerous in the NBA.
Yeah, and Bron, I don't want to kill him, because he did have a very, very nice offensive game. 8 of 12 at the rim, I mean, for 12 shots at the rim. He was a terror getting out in transition. Obviously, we talked about the Cavs. Only 2 of 9 from 3, though. Missed all 5 of his above-the-break shots, and including 2 wide-open threes in the last 2 minutes of the game, that either of which could have really changed the conception. He missed that one to tie late. Let's talk a little bit about the end of the game here. Boston went with their starting lineup, except with just Smart in for Hayward. So Tatum, he had a nice game. He had 14 points, 5 of 12 from the field. Did take some tough long twos. I did like that he at least looked comfortable taking the three-pointer. I thought that Kyrie, too, had, with 10 assists, did have a little bit nicer of an offensive game. He dimed some guys up in the pick and roll late as well. Where I wanted to pick it up, though, is the ATO, that, or the ATIO, as the Cavs like to call it, that the Cavs ran twice in the last couple of minutes for LeBron, where they had Wade pop to the elbow or the free throw line, and then just stationed Rose and Love on the weak side. Kyrie was being guarded, Crowder was being guarded by Kyrie. Crowder set the back screen for LeBron. Kyrie didn't help the first time, gave up an alley-oop dunk, and then the second time Smart came all the way over from the weak side to not guard Rose to stop the initial play again when Kyrie didn't help out that much. But then they triple teamed LeBron, and LeBron threw a great pass to the opposite side to Love in the corner for a three, one of those passes that, you know, not a lot of guys can make when you're facing that level of defensive pressure. But that was a good job by Lou attacking Kyrie, and he likes running those back screen sets for LeBron a lot out of timeouts. It's very difficult to guard.
Yeah, and I think it was that third guy that really caused the problems for Boston, because LeBron, you lose the benefit of really kind of speeding him up or stressing him out, and he has the vision to make that pass. And so, yeah, I mean, there's always been a peril with doubling him, and he found Love, hit him right in the pocket, and it was just a beautiful play that helped kind of give them a little bit more momentum, because Boston had been really chipping away at the lead that Cleveland had up to that point. I think that made it 96-95 from what I recall, right?
Yeah, and then after, oh, you're talking about that three. No, the three happened a little bit later, I think.
Oh, but you might be right.
Sorry, my notes are a little bit.
Oh yeah, because the
three here,
put him up by four.
It was,
that's right.
Right, exactly. I mean, Boston led this game by three with 2 minutes left, 98-95, and then only scored one more point, and Cleveland scored 7. But one of the big plays was Love beasting Jaylen Brown for an offensive rebound, and that was another one of those plays where he just didn't play physically enough. Love got 2 free throws out of that to bring him within 1 with about 1:40 left, and then Kyrie threw a beautiful pass to Smart after they switched. Rose couldn't find Smart fast enough after the switch. Smart with a great cut. LeBron helped from the weak side corner, and then they threw it. A good pass by Smart to Jaylen Brown, just all day to shoot a wide open three. And, you know, it wasn't a bad miss or anything, but it did not go in. And then it was a somewhat controversial play where LeBron attacked it in transition. This gave Cleveland the lead, and because it was transition, the Celtics, and just because they have a lot of young guys out there who don't know how to do this, they didn't help enough off of those non-shooters in transition, and LeBron just went right through Jaylen Brown again. He went to a jump stop and then pivoted. Some people were saying that this is a travel, and this is somewhat of a controversial rule where they say it's a travel if you land on a jump stop with your feet like not perfectly at the same time. I always thought that was just a useless distinction. I don't understand why it would matter whether your feet hit at the same time or one at a time. It's still the same number of steps. And then he pivoted, and that people were saying that was a travel. I didn't think it was. And if it is, it's a stupid rule, and there's no way the refs can tell in traffic in a loud arena whether the guy's feet hit at the same time. That's just, I always felt that was a stupid rule, and I thought it was a good move by LeBron and should not have been
trouble. And then the next play was another just a ridiculous one by LeBron, because it looked like Marcus Smart was going to be wide open as a part of an action that originally started as a pick and pop for Horford. LeBron came from the weak side, read the play beautifully, and was able to change possession, and that I think that was what really swung, because at that point, if you remember, it was only a 1-point lead. Boston had the ball, and then they, you know, go back the other way, and then it was only ever a single possession game on the last possession of the game.
Yeah, they ran that same play. That was the Love three after that. And then Shumpert committed a dumb off-ball foul before it was even inbounded. So Smart hit a free throw there to get him within three at 102-99. That ended up being the final score. Kyrie tried to drive, and we were joking that, hey, at least he got the 2-for-1 when he drove and took a pretty tough shot. Rose actually played pretty good one-on-one defense. Rose is better as a one-on-one defender. When you put him through screens, he can't get through him, but he at least still has the physical talent to defend one-on-one, and he made Kyrie's finish tough. He didn't even hit the rim on that attempted finish. LeBron then tried to run the clock down and shoot that three from the left wing, stepping to his left over Horford. And I love the fact that Stevens went with the no timeout after that. I especially love going for a no timeout when you need a three, because the other team can't be like, okay, no threes, no threes. And it worked out perfectly that way, right? They threw it ahead to Jaylen Brown, who's in transition. Derrick Rose, I mean, you're up three. You got to have your, with 7 seconds left, you got to have your heels at least on the three-point line. Rose backed off and just let Jaylen Brown shoot a wide open left wing three that they missed. And then LeBron, he wasn't able to get the rebound. Horford tapped it out to Kyrie on the right wing, but he was up there in the air fighting for that rebound. The ball got tapped out to Kyrie, and somehow no other Cav reacted to Kyrie except LeBron. LeBron got all the way from fighting for the rebound in the air, and somehow he was there when Kyrie caught the ball to make him put it on the floor, dribble, and shoot an impossible three that ended up airballing. Although someone in our midst did not think it was an airball.
Hey, it got nothing but net, man. Went in, which it got funny. Nothing but net. It just didn't go in the circle first. Yeah, I.
No, you let out a yell in the media room, and I was like, it didn't go in.
From my, yeah, I thought it did. And I kind of wanted it to. So that would have been so wonderful. But yeah, it was a great reflection those last couple minutes of how LeBron is so special defensively, making plays that very few other people do, both due to his athleticism and his recognition. I mean, that's what makes him special along with some other guys. So I thought it was a really impressive performance from him. Certainly some things that Boston can take away from that second half as they move forward. And unfortunately for them, they don't get there's no rest for the weary. They play at home on Wednesday night against the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yeah, that's not the back-to-back you want to be playing. And I mean, I think given how tragically the game started for Boston, you have to feel pretty good about where they ended up. I mean, to have Jaylen Brown have a game like this, Jason Tatum didn't look like a fish out of water. Al Horford looks like he's still the same guy this year so far. They got a nice contribution from Smart after he had a rough first half. And going to him in the post is something that they can get something out of. But, you know, this is a team that we thought was going to be an elite offensive squad. And now without Hayward, I'm not sure that that's going to be the case. And I think the other thing we didn't mention too going forward is, well, Kyrie wanted his own team. He's got it now. You know, I mean, this is, if he really is that great of a player, you know, you would hope, I mean, they still have a fair amount of talent around him. You know, he's going to have to lead this team to at least be solidly in the playoffs before people might say, all right, you know, like you wanted this team and now you weren't actually capable of rising to that challenge and really leading this team to victories.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And the Cavs, you know, I'm a little worried about them. We'll see. I mean, I want to see how their defense looks, but I mean, with Wade, Rose, and Love in the starting lineup, and then you got these two non-shooters with Rose and Wade, I think it could be difficult.
I don't have the right
for them. It's going to take some time.
I don't have the right analogy here. It's like a one of those logic puzzles. I don't know if we did them for LSAT prep, but those logic puzzles, but where you just like can't figure out where to line up the people, like that sort of a thing. And I think it's going to be a show.
Oh, I can figure it out. It's just with all the egos involved, it's just going to be difficult. And Brian Windhorst had a nice piece about this today where he said basically that, you know, they kind of realize that Wade isn't the best fit, but LeBron kind of owes Wade a little bit and they have this relationship and this is what LeBron wants. And so they're doing it essentially. And we'll see how long this lasts. But, you know, I don't expect them to have a ton of success right out of the gate here. All right, we'll get to Houston and Golden State, another great game, actually. But first, this from our friends at Draft. Fantasy basketball fans, it's time to try something new for Daily Fantasy. Draft is daily fantasy basketball, but not like the other guys because they're not using a salary cap league. Instead, you play with real live snake drafts with other people, but it means that with the snake draft, it's much harder for these professional players who win the majority of the money on traditional salary cap sites to anticipate how things are going to go in a snake draft. And it takes long enough. You can't just submit your lineup ahead of time. You actually put in 2 or 3 minutes, which is not that long for you. But if you're one of these pros who's has to trying to play in 100 games a night, they can't do that. So you're playing against, you know, actual real fans like yourself instead of professional players who are spending tens of hours a week studying this and coming up with the best lineups and getting these economies of scale. So that's why draft is a better way of doing it. They even take care of last minute injuries for you as well. And drafts start every couple of minutes. You could join one at any time, really. It just lasts for one night, so there's no management season long. You can play again every night if you want and play for cold hard cash. The drafts start from just $1, so there's a draft for everyone. The way to get started with them, search Draft in your app store and you can join a game or play right from your computer at draft.com. Just make sure you use my promo code CapSpace. That'll get you free entry into a draft when you make your first deposit. So you can play a real money game for free with that promo code CapSpace. Of course, let them know that you came from us as well. That's the Draft app or draft.com. Use that promo code CapSpace on your first deposit. Well, tough to take away a ton from this game about Golden State. Ring Knights have an odd psychology to them. Golden State was relatively dominating this game until Draymond Green went out. Andre Iguodala didn't play due to back stiffness. Green went out at the end of the third quarter with a strained left knee, but says afterwards that he's going to be fine. I thought really the bigger takeaway was I thought Houston looked great.
And they looked great in a lot of different ways. I thought Harden, both physically, you know, I thought he looked more lithe than usual, which was great. And Eric Gordon was spectacular in this game. He was doing it not really as a shooter, but as a driver. He was taking advantage of various situations, including Jordan Bell on one very nice drive and dunk. And that's something Eric Gordon can do that we sometimes lose appreciation for. He actually, you know, so he had a 24 point game and was 0 for 6 from three. That's awfully impressive from him. I thought PJ Tucker,
he had 4 and 1.
Wow.
In this game, Eric Gordon, I can't remember the last time we've seen a guard have 4 and 1s in one game. It was really impressive. I mean, and he, you know, he blew by Bell for that dunk. He was blown by everybody. He got Kevon Looney, he got I think Klay Thompson. Like, he really was just getting to the basket as well. It was incredibly impressive. I mean, it's not like he was shooting mid-rangers. That was all around the rim, essentially, for him. And in fact, he was 9 of 16 and he took 8 free throw attempts, and so that meant he was 9 of 10 from 2-point range. Really, really impressive game for him. He was plus 16. And then you're about to mention the great game that PJ Tucker
20 points, plus 20, 4 of 6 from 3, 4 of 6 from the line, both of which were very important in this game. And, you know, played strong defense, you know, stout guy, really provide that. And actually, one of the biggest plays of this game down the stretch was not in any of those ways. It was an offensive rebound. He had, I believe it was Sean Livingston on him. He was, you know, he's much stronger than Sean Livingston, and drew a foul, which ended up giving Houston an opportunity to score more points and push the margin.
Yeah, Tucker, I mean, now, you know, he hit 4 of his first 5 3-point attempts. And I was a little skeptical of that signing because Tucker had been such a zero offensively in Phoenix to some degree, and really in Toronto, where he just wasn't taking that many shots. And his jumper looks even better in terms of catch and shoot. Like, he had 1 3 where he popped up from the left corner. He replaced to the left wing, caught it on the move. Nice hop into a three. No, you didn't see that hitch as much in his shot. So that was fantastic. He's not going to shoot that well on threes every game, but overall Houston, I mean, they shot 37% on 41 attempts. So it's not like, you know, they had some incredible shooting, and the Warriors actually did. They were 16 out of 30 and still lost from three, which is pretty remarkable. And Mbamute was the other one, right? He 14 points, 6 of 9 from him. Those guys combining for 6 of 9 from three. And you really saw down the end that when they went to that lineup with Tucker at center, Golden State, especially because they didn't have Green in there and Andre in there, who are much better about helping and recovering and knowing when to help and who to help off of, then, you know, I mean, they had McCaw in there, they had Looney. Sean Livingston's a little smarter, but not the same way as Andre and Draymond are. So they were worried about those guys shooting threes as when they had gotten 6 for 9. And I do think that Houston's culture, to some degree, where it's just, hey, bomb a three, like, this is your job, you're coming out if you don't shoot it, can help the confidence of guys like that. Never helped Corey Brewer, but guys like this, it can help. So this was really the absolute peak of what Daryl Morey could have wanted, playing Tucker at center and Bamute in there as well, switching everything, and then those guys doing enough offensively that they're able to keep both score on their own and keep the defense honest, so that James Harden was able to go to work late in the game as well.
And Harden had to go to work late in the game because Chris Paul was on the floor. He played 33 minutes, but it did not include crunch time. And, you know, it seems like he was dealing with a lingering leg issue. But also, they had five players that were doing great, so they didn't have to worry about that as much. They didn't have to push him, which I think is a wonderful thing. And what struck me in this game, really from the opening tip, was I saw cleanly and plainly what Houston would do in a theoretical seven-game series against the Warriors. D'Antoni likes these tight, short rotations. Nene got a DNP coach's decision, and the way that they attacked the Warriors, the way that they, you know, maybe Ryan Anderson played more in this than he probably would, and some other things, but by and large, if you see, you know, the chemistry and all of that will build with this team, it looked like the future. It looked like what we're going to see in mid to late May.
Yeah, and I'm definitely happy to see this matchup. I hope that Paul can be a little bit healthier. I mean, he's 4 points, 2 for 9, limping around, especially, did have 11 assists, but definitely, he had 11 assists, Harden had 10. I mean, and I think that there are, it's been written about, but they are likely to break the record for the person who has the second most assists on a per game on a team, with these guys. And so we'll see. I mean, he even wasn't himself defensively too. He got taken advantage of a couple times in the post, which you don't see as often from him, got into foul trouble. You mentioned the centers. Clint Capela was negative 23 in 18 minutes, despite having 12 points in those 18 minutes. And then Nick Young for Golden State, the crowd was going absolutely crazy. 6 of 7 from three, 23 points on 9 shooting possessions for him, and somehow he managed to be minus 10. And Swaggy P definitely still looking a bit corpulent, and while he hit his shots, at least the defensive renaissance that he had with the Lakers last year appears to be quite in the rearview mirror, at least until he's able to tone up.
It was also made so much worse by the Warriors not having normal help defense, both due to personnel and due to the Rockets being the Rockets. So when he was a turnstile, and this is actually something I've talked about with James Harden before, is also Nick Young, when he lets a guy go by him, it's even faster than it is a normal guy. And so it gives the defenders less time to help. And so that was a problem on a few of the possessions where the guy was just gone, or he blew a switch or something like that. And, you know, that's a part of the Nick Young experience. And he's not going to have shooting nights like this all the time, but he will at certain points. And that is really the value for the Warriors, is that incandescent scoring. But I think what the biggest takeaway on the Warriors side, other than Draymond Green is important, surprise, surprise, was when their offense was humming, when they really had something close to their best lineups out there, they looked incredible offensively.
Yeah, I thought that Houston, though, did a good job defending them in the half court, and especially when Houston went with their lineups with Tucker and Bamute out there. And what really killed them was just in transition, they were horrible. They gave up 36 fast break points and probably had 7 or 8 possessions, even off a make sometimes, where they just didn't know who they had and didn't match up in transition at all. And that was definitely an issue that they need to clean up. And I think probably will always be an issue. I just, you know, I don't necessarily trust these guys. Harden, in particular, he had a couple of follow-ups. Anderson had some follow-ups. Capela has some skills, but he's not really the most aware, intelligent defender. So maybe they can get there, but I mean, you really got to be on it in transition defense against Golden State. And Golden State led this 101-89 or 88 after three, and then just they couldn't score much in the fourth quarter, got outscored 10-3 down the end, and we'll talk about that down the end. But no, I mean, the Warriors are going to look great, and we saw through most of the game, Steph Curry only played 29 minutes. He got in foul trouble with his usual stupid-ass reaches. We saw Draymond get in foul trouble earlier on as well. KD got into foul trouble. It didn't play as many minutes, but early on as well. And the story through three, I thought, was that the Warriors' depth, it didn't matter. But then once Draymond went out, it became a problem. And then what I really want to talk about, too, we can get into the end of the game here, was Golden State's defense, you know, partially without the communication of Draymond and Iguodala out there, just had no answers for just the basic thing that Houston and everybody else and their brother tries to run at the end of games, is just just getting Steph Curry guarding Harden.
And I thought there were certain moments where Curry did a decent job, not as much at the very end of the game, but if you don't really have a way to counter that or something to a way to really deal with it, then, you know, Harden's going to have big performances. He's going to have some nice shots, and they were able to generate reliable offense during the end of the game. And I guess you could say that's a concern. Obviously, the personnel is going to be different, but it is notable all the same.
Yeah, and that was really the vision, right? Is that, okay, we can stop him because we got Tucker and we got Luke out there. And then, yeah, you know, those guys aren't great threats, but just James Harden going one-on-one in a small pick and roll is enough. And Harden, by the way, I mean, he didn't have the most amazing statistical game, but just the way he looks, I mean, you can actually see some definition in the guy's arms again. You know, he looks closer to where he was physically when he first got to Houston, and what he was able to do, his stamina was excellent. He didn't run out of gas towards the end of the games, which happened a lot. And he was actually able to make that strategy work, which he wasn't necessarily at times last year down the end of games. And just, he was blowing by guys, getting to the rim. He blew past Klay Thompson, just straight one-on-one, blew past Jordan Bell, who's a solid switch defender. We'll talk about him a little bit more later on. But just the juice that he had off the bounce, he and Gordon, both of those guys, was really, really impressive. And I think Harden deserves a lot of credit for addressing the fact that he kind of porked up a little bit, and his body looks much better, and he's just much faster now.
Do you want to move towards the end of the game now, or do you want to talk about Jordan Bell and Kerr's rotations first?
Yeah, I think we could do that. I mean, Bell was the McAdoo replacement. We talked about him as he's going to be the speed guy when they didn't want to go with Draymond at center. And he came in, and despite not playing terrible defense necessarily on any of these possessions, he got beat for a dunk by Eric Gordon. He had a three hit in his eye by Harden. I think Gordon scored on him again as well. But I thought it was good to see Kerr bring him back out there again, stick with the same strategy of switching everything. And Bell was much more effective defensively in the second half. I think he's going to get to be a quality guy. Obviously, he's going to just have to learn what it's like defensively guarding some of the big stars in the league one-on-one. And then offensively, I thought he was pretty good. He ended up with 8 points in his 12 minutes, 4 or 5 from the field. And I think one thing that's kind of underrated about him, you know, he kind of has this, you know, Ben Wallace light comparison, but he's much more facile around the rim. He did a nice off foot finish. It moves the ball around, avoids shot blockers. Like, he's not quite a nuclear athlete as far as going up to dunk, although he can get some alley-oops. But he can catch and finish around the rim nicely. And then he also got 2 dunks just slipping screens for Klay Thompson. He's already getting pretty good at that. There was an incident in the preseason where Draymond Green told him, hey, be ready to slip the screen, and he got a dunk. And so he already did that twice, totally fooled the Rockets on those plays using the gravity of the Warriors shooters. So I think he's going to be a player well worth $3.5 million to acquire the pick.
And that's cash considerations is now the backup power forward for the Bulls. So we'll see how that works out. But,
oh man, yeah, I guess we got to talk about that at the end of this too, because that happened after
we'll talk about it after. But so with Bell, the other, you talked about how he's the McAdoo replacement. I do think that is what he is long term, but they ended up using him in this game actually as the JaVale McGee stopgap. So he's playing at the end of the first quarter, played at the end of the third, and then they used Kevon Looney as the McAdoo kind of replacement, which was mind-blowing, because Looney, you know, there's questions about whether they're even going to pick up his fourth year option. But that does tie in with one of the Kerr things, which is when he doesn't feel he should play a traditional center, he's going to go with that type of a guy. And so eventually that spot will be Jordan Bell and Draymond Green, but for this game it was Jordan Bell and Kevon Looney. Looney, I thought he was better in the first half than in the second half, and part of that is just because the Rockets put so much stress on your help defenders by virtue of the lineups they put out there.
I don't know why you went back to Looney in for the major portion of the fourth quarter. D West and Zaza were getting torched. Just those guys cannot be out there in pick and roll defense. Like, you basically can't play conventional pick and roll defense against Houston. And so they tried to switch with Looney, and he had a couple of moments. He got a steal, had a nice rebound. But he looks more svelte himself. He's moving a little better, but still, you know, not a guy who can be out there for big minutes. I don't know why they didn't just go back to Belly. It had a nice stint in the third quarter. I certainly felt he should have closed the game, and then they finally eventually went to KD at center, and that didn't really seem to work out that well either. You would ask, hey, Nick Young had 23 points on 9 shots. Why wouldn't he be out there? I thought he should have been out there for that very last possession where they advanced the ball as a shooting threat, but I think they just can't trust him to execute the system. And he was so bad defensively that I think they're just like, you know what? He hit these shots. That's great. But, we can't trust him to execute.
For those of you who see the Warriors in person this year, especially recommend use this, use SeatGeek, use the promo code CAPSPACE. Watch how much attention the other Warriors give Nick Young when they're on defense. Like, I remember there were a few times where Sean Livingston is just pointing to people and being like, that's where you need to go. That's what you need to do. And it's basically every guy on the Warriors' job to tell Nick Young where to be. And it's amusing because they usually are so reliable in that way. And so incorporating him is going to be this kind of a challenge. And they'll make it work. You know, it's not the biggest thing in the world. If he's not good, they won't play him. But it is worth watching because the Warriors are going to have high stakes. They'll probably have like a 5 to 10 minute stretch where Nick Young's defense is going to matter.
So at the end of the game, we can pick it up here. It was 119-118. Steph blew by Trevor Ariza in a move that made the crowd gasp. And then they swung it around to Patrick McCaw, who hit a corner three that wasn't actually a corner three. Patrick kind of steps forward a little bit with his right foot. Not a ton of room in that corner, but I mean, that him not being able to get behind the three-point line on that shot actually cost them the game. They lost by one. But they're up three there. And then Harden came right back, and this is one of the many times that they screwed up guarding the small pick and roll. Steph and Clay. Steph was trying to stay attached to Harden and let Clay get back, failed to do so, and then Clay failed to do so, and then Harden just waltzed right in for a layup. And the other guys, I mean, you've got Tucker out there. It was Tucker, Ariza, and Mbah Mute. The fact that you'd have no help at the rim at all from guys like KD and McCaw and Sean Livingston, like those guys should know better to at least like not give up a layup and force one of those guys. I mean, they were up three, so maybe that was a concern, but that was pretty ugly. Then the next play, Eric Gordon did a great job of stripping KD in the post after they tried what was actually a 1-5 pick and roll. They run this play a lot where Steph will run an Iverson cut and then usually the center will sprint out, but to the wing to get a quick pick and roll, but Steph got bumped off of his spot, and then KD, who's like not the greatest at moving off the ball with force, took forever to get over there because he was getting ridden, and they didn't really get a clean look at it. They had to settle for a switch, and then Gordon just stripped KD going to his left. And you know, the Warriors offense, I mean, they got a couple of good looks, but Houston, again, you know, they didn't blow it defensively down the end as you would expect a lot of teams to, and they forced the Warriors to go one-on-one or throw it away as they did once.
And then I thought one of the stories of this game was just that I think Houston was very well prepared to play the Warriors. Just they knew what they were going to do. They knew what they wanted to do. Yeah. And an example that you keyed on more than I did was that they were doing it with switching. They were countering. The Warriors have gotten better over the years at pre-switching, but so Houston would just set a double screen so they could get the guy they wanted anyway.
Yeah. And now in the finals, Golden State was much more locked in on that, right? Like, you know, Draymond was there directing traffic. If there's a double screen, they'd make sure that whoever came out the end, you know, wasn't Steph Curry trying to guard LeBron, and Steph just got stuck on Harden pretty much every time. Did an okay job. I mean, he actually stopped Harden the last two times. But this was really the play of the game where Harden drove, missed a floater. PJ Tucker kept it alive. The ball got swung to Eric Gordon, who took a deep three. That rimmed in and out. And then Tucker got another rebound over Sean Livingston and went to the foul line, hit two free throws. And that ended up giving Houston that final margin of 122-121 after Golden State then couldn't score on their last possession.
Yeah, and so then it was just a bad pass on the second to last possession. So then Houston got the ball back, but they had to.
Well, can I talk about that real quick? Because they had Sean Livingston was being guarded by Ariza. He went up to set the screen for Curry, and it looked like they were going to double Curry. And then Ariza, I thought, actually made a great play. I didn't think this was it wasn't a great pass. And Livingston maybe could have attacked the ball a little bit more, but it looked like Livingston had slipped the screen successfully and Ariza was able to get back to him and deflect that pass, which was impressive. Harden then missed a three on Steph, and it looked like PJ Tucker had committed an over the backbreaker on KD, which would have given the Warriors free throws, except they weren't in the penalty somehow at the end. You'll see that a lot with the Warriors. And so they had to run the last play from half court to try and win the
Ariza
game.
Ariza actually got a deflection, ran some of the time off, and then contested the other one, so they had to start that last play in the backcourt. And then so you had Luke, Richard, and Mbah Mute, who's in the game, right decision, get on to Steph, it's a crazy play because he ended up, Steph got a way better look than I expected eventually, but it just, you know, it's a make or miss league.
Yeah, and it was, the play design was to start Klay Thompson screening for Steph Curry. He then sprinted to the opposite side of the floor after which KD set a pretty good screen for Steph. And Mba Mute went for the steal. Steph just beat him to the ball and then was wide open. Tucker tried to break through, couldn't do it. I mean, it's as good a look as you can expect. I mean, maybe you might want to get a two there, but it's a wide open three for Steph Curry. That missed, though, and Sean Livingston made two great plays to tap it. He found Durant, and Harden did well to get out to Durant and just make him put it on the floor. Durant could have probably still gone up, but he felt he had time to put it on the floor and get the shot off. Everyone live thought that it was good, but then it was clear that it was too late. And the Rockets won. It was somewhat of a similar feel, I thought, to the game that the Draymond Green kicking James Harden in the head game that went into double overtime last year, where Golden State Green ended up out of it by the end. I think Steph fouled out as well. He was in foul trouble this game. And so Houston won this war of attrition at the end. The difference being that I thought Houston's offense looked much better down the end of this one than it did in that game last year, where it ended up being, as I said, this war of attrition. So, you know, I think good start for Houston, especially considering that they got nothing from Chris Paul in this game. Their main guys look good. And I mean, that's all you can take. I'm not going to favor them to beat the Warriors. The Warriors were significantly handicapped by both foul trouble and injuries. Omri Caspi also, like, after James Harden flopped to the ground to try and draw a call, slipped on his wet spot and re-sprained his ankle. So he's someone who might have been playing at the end too for the Warriors. So they were very shorthanded, not going to hit the panic button there. Our 69 win projection is not looking as good after this one loss. But I think it was more really about Houston playing well in this one than Golden State just
being so terrible. Yeah, I would completely agree with that. And it's going to be exciting to watch Houston all year. They're going to have to still figure a lot of this out. But the elements that I think made us both so excited about this team are absolutely there.
Let's talk about this crazy Mirotić-Portis thing. The two had been jostling and a few trips up and down the floor. This is per reporting from Casey Johnson, among others. And Shams, I think, broke it initially. Woj was in there too. You know, they engaged in some shoving. And I think Casey had the closest, was most specific about it, that there was only one punch thrown. And the only punch was thrown by Portis. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, we weren't there, obviously. Can't say necessarily if they were shoving each other already that's necessarily a sucker punch, but you know, you probably don't expect that from your teammate, just punch you in the face. And Mirotić, big problems. I mean, he has a concussion. He was down on the floor for a matter of minutes afterwards, like facial fractures. They're talking about 4 to 6 weeks of him being out now. Portis is going to be suspended at least multiple games. The league office is involved. I can't remember the last time a teammate injured another teammate this badly. I mean, even that OJ Mayo, Tony Allen thing wasn't anywhere close to where the guy is going to miss this much time. I can't think of this ever happening where a teammate punched another teammate and he missed like months, you know, or a month. I mean, this is, the more I think about it, almost an unprecedented incident. And now you have to wonder, like, what's the discipline going to be for Portis? Are they going to decline his option? I mean, it seems almost unfair if he is able to come back before Mirotić. He's almost going to benefit from punching his own teammate because he's going to get the playing time.
I did not want to learn about maxillary fractures. Mid-face, not fun. I mean, and the Bulls are saying surgery is likely required. That's where you get to the 4 to 6 week time frame. And it's such a shame. I mean, Portis is playing for, you know, his NBA career. Mirotić has basically a team option for next year, and the Bulls, you know, while we don't have high hopes for them, you know, you at least wanted to see them at you know, maybe not full strength, but at something close to it. And who knows what the ripple effects of this are going to be long term. The silver lining of sorts is that Lauri Markkanen is probably going to get a much better opportunity to show himself, and they will have an opportunity to evaluate him with whoever the heck their starters are. But I mean, it's just a tough situation to start a year with. It just puts kind of, it's not the same kind of pall as what happened to Gordon Hayward, but it's certainly another kind of cloud.
Well, and then, I mean, can you imagine that? Like, those two guys having to be teammates after this? Like, and Portis, I guess the organization kind of believes in it, but looks like it was trending in the way that Portis might be out of the rotation behind Markkanen and Mirotić. So I guess Markkanen is just going to start at the four now. They also could make Paul Zipser the four, but unfortunately, he's also the only three that they have. So, I mean, maybe Denzel Valentine will play at the three, but then they don't really have a ton of depth on the wing there either, with Zach LaVine out and Pondexter out, and who knows if he's going to come back. He's got this hamstring injury. He'll probably get a chance at some point. You know, Lopez and Felicio, you can't really play those guys together. So, I mean, Markkanen is going to probably play 30 minutes a game, but Mirotić might have been this team's best player. And now he's going to miss these probably 4 to 6 weeks. I mean, it's really just pretty bad and just not cool by Bobby Portis, obviously. And I mean, you know, I think especially with his, considering his middling talent, like I would think very seriously if I were the Bulls about just simply like, I mean, I don't know what the circumstances were. Maybe Mirotić just said something that was like so out of line to him. But, you know, Nico seems like a pretty nice guy. He's a little bit of an irritant. But I mean, you just, to lose your cool like that in a practice and like injure the guy that seriously, I mean, all right, it's fine if you want to like get into some shoving or you want to tackle the guy or whatever, but like that kind of a punch that can do that kind of damage is just like really beyond the pall. And so I mean, I think especially considering Portis's talent level, like I might consider just releasing the guy, frankly.
You have to consider it, and as you said, there's a lot of context that we don't know, but it's, you know, at that point, just with the issues with the locker room, I think you really want to talk not only with these two players but with the rest of the players too, to get a sense of where they are on this, because if it fractures the locker room, that's a big problem. You know, not only, you know, if players are on different sides, because whether or not Bobby Portis and Nikola Mirotić are on this team long term, a lot of their other guys probably will be, and so you want them to be on the same page.
Let's get some news now. The biggest thing that's happened since we last recorded is this LaMarcus Aldridge extension, which came absolutely out of nowhere. What happened here is he opted in to the last year of his deal, and that was for $22.3 million, and then he was allowed to get an extension on top of that starting at 120% of his salary for next year. And that means that he's able to get up to $26 million, which he did, actually maybe a little bit more than that, which he did for 2019-20. And then in 2020-21, he's due $24 million. Only $7 million of that is guaranteed, with a guarantee date of 6/29 in 2020. So there wasn't necessarily a deadline here, because if you have 2 years left on your contract, which he does still, you can only do it up until the season starts. But he could have just opted out later in the season and signed for the exact same amount next year. It would have been a little bit different, because you couldn't have had as big of a gap between the 2 years, and maybe that's what they were trying to go for, to keep his salary a little bit lower for next year. But anyway, Danny, what did you think of this whole thing?
First of all, it was a really big surprise. And for reference, this covers his age 33, 34, and the partially guaranteed season is his age 35 season, because his birthday is during the offseason. So it's pretty clean in terms of that. And I think that it's not terrible money for him, but at the same point, I don't think they got a real big value here, which is why you do an extension. You know, an extension is supposed to be, to a degree, risk mitigation from both sides, and I don't think there was a lot of risk mitigation from the Spurs here. There was a ton from Aldridge's perspective, and then you also have to see this in the collective, and the collective here is what San Antonio did this entire summer, because they were looking like they could be on the precipice of being one of the major players in the 2018 offseason. Kawhi Leonard's last year on this relatively cheap contract, just because of the way the salary cap jumped. Instead, now they're locked in with LaMarcus. They're locked in with Pau Gasol, who's making almost $17 million next year. Patty Mills is probably making about $12 million. I don't have the exact figures for him yet. And so that's a lot of money that they've committed. And so the reasonable expectation has to be that the Spurs we see in 2018-19 are going to be very similar to the Spurs we see this year.
Yeah. Aldridge also will not be eligible to be traded now for 6 months, because this extension is too long under the Melo rule, so they can't trade him this year. Now he's going to be on the team for sure this year. Maybe next off season he could potentially be traded.
Well, and but it has a trade bonus. A 15% trade
bonus.
That's
right. As did his last contract. So there's no way they're going to be able to negotiate out of that to take that away this time, if you already had it. You know, just do the anchoring there. So I mean, let's look at it. Try to understand what the Spurs are thinking. I think, number one, they assumed, hey, he's going to opt in next year to this $22.3 million. And that having that impression maybe is what drove a lot of some of these things that they've done, where they used up some of their cap space with Patty Mills, used it up with Gasol, though I think that a lot of that was just to get him to opt out so they would have flexibility last year. And now, because they failed there, maybe this is a little bit of an overreaction against going the cap space route. So Aldridge, let's say he was going to opt in there, and then it's really only, you know, the next year is the $26 million. I think he's nearly certain to be overpaid at that amount in 2019. 1920. But keep in mind that his max would have been $35 million. And in 2019-20, it's supposed to jump a little bit. So his max might even have been closer to $37 million that year. And then he's got the $7 million guarantee for the year after that, which is a fair amount of money still. Even if you stretch that, that's going to be over $2 million. And so I think it's pretty likely that they will, in fact, either trade him or just cut him at that point. You know, there's no way he's going to be worth, I think, $24 million as a 35-year-old that year. But just what generally, and so I understand maybe, all right, you know, this is like okay value. It reminds me a little bit of the Tony Parker extension they did, which has turned out to be a terrible deal. But Aldridge doesn't have the equity of that Tony Parker did with the organization, where there's really like a need to take care of him. So I just think that if you want it, like, this might help them. It maybe lowers their downside risk a little bit, because maybe you could have left for nothing and maybe they couldn't replace him. I would rather just have $26 million on the 2019 free agent market than LaMarcus Aldridge. But you know, I guess they see it differently.
Yeah, I mean, we all had kind of fallen in love with the prospect of what they could do really rebuilding around Kawhi Leonard. And what my wonder here is, we've always assumed that this is Tony Parker's last year under contract with the Spurs, or at least on a high value deal. Considering the way that they took care of LaMarcus, can we be sure of that anymore? Like, if Parker shows a little bit from and, you know, at the end of this year, that they just say, hey, we've already spent the money, and go into it. And it's disappointing for me from that perspective, because I like every team to reach their potential. But, you know, the Spurs are cultivating an MO, I guess, and choosing a strange place to continue that, because, as you said, he hadn't built up the equity.
The big thing, and KP noted this at the end of his piece, was we loved where they were as an organization, because in the summer of 2018, which would have been the last year that Kawhi Leonard is going to be a pretty small amount. The next year after that, he has a player option, but he's going to opt out of that in the summer of 2019. And then his cap hold is going to go up to $30 million. And he'll almost certainly be eligible for the designated player veteran extension at that point as well. So he's going to have a massive cap charge after that going forward. So really, it was incumbent upon them either this last summer when they tried and failed, or this next summer, that's your last chance to add a star next to Kawhi Leonard. And when you consider some of the powerhouses that are in the league at this point, LaMarcus Aldridge is not that star. He's only declining. Pau Gasol, certainly not that star. If you look at guys that they have in the pipeline, I mean, unless DeJounte Murray becomes another Tony Parker, that's really about all they have in terms of options now. They don't have any outs to find that star, unless they're going to try and trade Aldridge. Maybe they think he's going to be worth something, but they don't have the chips to compete with a team like Boston or plenty of other teams in terms of having some ammo for a team with a disgruntled star that's trying to rebuild. LaMarcus Aldridge is not going to be that player, and he's going to just continue to get worse. It just, to me, maybe they lower their downside a little bit, but the path to remaining in championship contention was always going to be, hey, you know what, we're going to get a second star to pair with Kawhi Leonard. Yeah, you know, they were great last year. They were kind of close to Golden State, but Aldridge is only going to get worse after that. And it's just, it seems like really a missed opportunity to me. And odds are now that they never find that second star.
Agreed. And one of the other intriguing things about the beginning of this week is it was the extension deadline for, as you said, you know, for guys that have multiple years remaining on their contract, and also for rookie scale extensions. And LaMarcus was really the only one that happened in that window. There were, of course, a fair number of extensions we've already talked about on Dunked On that already occurred. And so a lot of players are going to be grinding this year, knowing that they're going into an extremely narrow restricted market next summer.
Yes, that's right. And let's get to these non-extensions now, basically. I mean, did we have any other ones? I don't think we did since we last discussed
I think
it was Gary Harris.
And Wiggins.
Yeah, Wiggins happened. We talked about him. Mm-hmm. And so really, I mean, I think we only had three. Who's the third one that I'm forgetting?
Joel Embiid.
Yes. So those are the only three. That's got to be
TJ Warren also had one.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. So that's four. And I would also say that pretty much all of those extensions were player friendly, which usually the extension should be a little bit more team friendly. But I think what really was an issue was the extensions that happened, and even the veteran contracts that were given out in the summer of 2017, even though that was a correction from 2016, people don't understand that it's going to be even tighter in 2018. And so it's really going to be difficult now. All of these restrictive rates, some of them are going to be out in the cold. I think teams are going to get some pretty darn good deals. And guys like, you know, Marcus Smart or Nurkic or Rodney Hood. I mean, I don't know how much those guys were getting offered, but I would be surprised if a lot of these guys do as well in restricted free agency as they might have gotten in an extension. And don't forget, too, an extension, you've got a whole year of risk before then that you're shifting onto the team. So unless these guys just absolutely blow up, I think many of them will regret not taking the offers that were made.
The other huge weight that is on a lot of these players is that they're not in situations where they gain leverage because other suitors would think that their team won't match. Like, let's say Zach LaVine is a great example of this. Zach LaVine has to go to that other team and basically say, you're making me an offer sheet so the Bulls will match it. You know, you're not sitting there saying, oh, you can steal me away. And that's a big problem for a lot of these guys. I would say that's a big issue for Jusuf Nurkic, for Aaron Gordon in all likelihood, possibly Elfrid Payton. So even these guys that are intriguing, Marcus Smart could be another one of these if he has a good year, then teams, there aren't that many teams with space in the first place, and the teams with space are going to have to wait out the other process, and they're not going to want to be used as pawns because there are so few teams with money that they can do better things with it.
Here are the teams that I project to have more money than the mid-level exception next year: Atlanta, Brooklyn, if Lin opts out, Chicago, Indiana, the Lakers, Philly. San Antonio is probably out of those sweepstakes now. So that is... and Dallas, maybe in that market too. So that's seven teams. Now, many of those are not going to wait around for restricted free agents. A lot of those are kind of in rebuilding mode. But think of all the guys who turned down extensions here, right? Like Aaron Gordon, Elfrid Payton, LaVine, Jusuf Nurkic, Rodney Hood. And then you still got Jabari Parker out there, Smart, Clint Capella, Julius Randle will probably be in that mix. So, I mean, you've got more than seven players. Not all seven of those teams are going to make offers to restricted free agents, are going to wait around until, and it's not even July 8th now, whatever team it is going to do the BS that the Wizards did with the physical to make it until like July 10th or 12th or something. You really think that all these teams, like, there are going to be a lot of guys out in the cold with just no offers next summer. And I think maybe the players just couldn't stomach it because they saw guys like Evan Turner or, you know, Tim Hardaway or this year, or just some of the crazy contracts that went around. They're like, hey, I'm better than that guy. And they're right. They're better than that guy. But the market is just different now. And I think maybe that some of these guys at least could have said, hey, you know, let's go for something where have a shorter duration and I can get back on the market sooner potentially, or take a lower in an annual value now just to get some security and then get back on the market sooner with a player option. But it just seems like all of these guys did not make the right decision. And, you know, I'm sure it'll come out of like what these guys actually were offered. But I think most of them are going to get less in restricted free agency and they're going to get less security.
And you talked about risk. The other part to consider here is that for a lot of these guys, their best quote unquote resource there is going to be threatening to sign a qualifying offer. Then they're going to be an unrestricted free agent another year, be paying taking a lot less money for that year and taking on a whole lot of risk. So there aren't many outs. It's going to be a really, really grisly, protracted offseason for a lot of these guys.
All right, we have a trade to announce here. The Cavaliers, with the signing of Dwayne Wade, had 16 players. Kay Felder was kind of always going to get cut. And so they then traded a second rounder and cash to Atlanta with Richard Jefferson, who had been set to make $2.5 million, still going to make that, but ended up getting cut by the Hawks. Same with Kay Felder, who was cut by the Hawks. The Bulls then claimed him off waivers, so the Hawks save a bunch of money. Too bad for Cleveland that they had to give up some money to trade Felder away with his guarantee, only to have him get claimed off waivers. So the Hawks get to save that money now, not the Cavs. But that transaction does save Cleveland about $12 million, so probably worth it to send $3 million in cash plus that second rounder to save yourself $12 million. And then Jefferson now is glommed on with the Denver Nuggets, who we were speculating, who are they going to waive? Who are they going to waive? They have this full roster. And surprisingly enough, they waived Jameer Nelson, of all players, even though he has guaranteed money. Nelson should be someone that a point guard desperate team, the Hornets, could really use, although they're so close to the tax that they're probably going to think twice about it unless they can get off some other money. And all some musical chairs here, but what I think the financial component we've covered, but what do you think of what Denver decided to do here?
It's a really big risk to put so much on their young point guards. I mean, so now Jamal Murray and Emmanuel Mudiay are really the only guys they have that can play that position.
But like, I mean, I don't think Nelson was even that much better than those guys. I mean, he was like, well, it's okay, that much better, he's the veteran,
but it's like
option.
If somebody gets hurt, you know, if that over the course of the season, yeah, they have Monty Morris on a two-way contract, but that's a rookie point guard. And this Denver team has expectations.
But like, so, Harris and Barton can handle the ball. I think I think
they'll survive
will
it if they have to. But and RJ can certainly help because they need it, as they have an army of forwards, but those forwards are not small forwards. So I think they can benefit from that. I don't need to rehash my issues with their offseason outside of the Millsap move, which was great. And so I'm not going to, but RJ will add some depth to them. And the Nuggets benefited in the last couple of years from having a veteran small forward, you know, a high character guy to kind of get their guys in line. That was Mike Miller before. So RJ can fill that role for them.
Yeah, and with them losing Nelson, they do need still that old head available in what could be a difficult locker room with all these guys who think they should be playing. And the one thing to watch here, Juan Hernan Gomez, maybe this means he plays more at the four and Trey Lyles is out of the rotation, or maybe it means that he and Lyles split time at the four and Jefferson plays more, or it means still that Hernan Gomez is going to be the backup three still. He's looked better as a backup three than I expected. Still think his best position is the four. So we'll see. They may end up playing RJ a little bit too much. They obviously were competing with other teams to sign him. We'll see whether he has anything left as well. He had a really rough regular season last year, had some moments at times in the playoffs, but I mean, I think just getting some more depth in like a real three is something they need to do. It's just, you know, always a concern, especially with Mike Malone, that he might get played a little bit too much.
On the injury front, a couple of different notable ones. Dante Exum decided to have surgery, and while that's disappointing, not in terms of a decision, but in terms that he has to have surgery, we don't know the exact timeline yet, but he was looking, you know, like the clear-cut backup point guard there. That duty now falls, I would say it's probably to Raul Neto. They could do a couple different things with it, but the Jazz, you know, now the Jazz had figured that out, and he's another guy who, for more logical reasons, some of the other ones, is going to be going into the restricted market next year.
Yeah, and we don't know precisely what the timetable is going to be for Exum yet. It's possible still that he could return this season. Doesn't have that feeling, but it's possible. We don't know that he's out for sure yet. Couple other ones here that we can talk about. Kawhi Leonard not expected to play in the season opener. We talked about that on the predictions, but still worth reiterating. We still have no idea how long he's going to be out. You never know with the Spurs, but the fact that he was ruled out so soon before the season opener, certainly an issue. Memphis, some interesting cuts. Actually, we'll do some injuries first. George Hill hoping to make his debut on Wednesday. He's got a groin issue. That was something that plagued him in addition to that toe last year. That's something to watch, although I happen to think for the Kings it might be better if just De'Aaron Fox gets the keys sooner rather than later there. Andre Iguodala questionable for, actually we shouldn't say that because we were recording this beforehand, but he actually either played or didn't in the in the game today, so no point in discussing that. Joel Embiid had some interesting comments today, saying basically that he thinks the minutes limit that he's going to be on, we don't know exactly what that's going to be yet, is fucking bullshit.
My virgin ears. But yeah, I mean, we'll have fun on Wednesday's Twitter NBA show covering that game and then the Spurs without Kawhi. I mean, there's just going to be a lot to talk about with those teams. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on here. But let's get into the final roster decisions with some of these teams, because these were significant. So Memphis had a crunch. Like, they had a lot of guaranteed spots and they had a lot of guys who outperformed. So what they ended up doing was they kept Mario Chalmers, Andrew Harrison, and Jarrell Martin, who it had previously been reported they basically told he was going to cut. And they cut Wade Baldwin, who was a late first round pick in 2016, and Rade Zagorac, who they just gave a 3-year contract to. And that is significant, first of all, because it is them cutting bait on some things that they had real investment in. And I think that's the right decision if you think that those guys were the worst players, but that is money on their books. And Memphis did shed a fair amount of money this year from veterans, at least partially probably because they, you know, were worried about the tax and all that. And this was, in a way, wasted money. And then the other big question that I have here is Jarrell Martin, because of the new timeline, he still has 2 weeks to see whether his option gets picked up. And if they don't pick up his option, then that seems like a real waste, because if he's good enough that he's on the roster and his option isn't worth that much money, they might as well pick it up.
Yeah, really weird that it came out at the start of camp that he was likely going to get waived. And then I guess he just played so well in camp that they're like, all right, we'll keep this guy around. And Wade Baldwin had shown very little in his rookie year and in summer league. But man, I mean, it's usually like not even one guy per year who gets his 30-year option decline and gets away. I mean, RJ Hunter was the one guy that last year. And I will say this, I can't recall any time that anyone along those lines has ever gone on to do something. And certainly you would have to say that perhaps his attitude problems had something to do with this. And he was supposed to be this really athletic guy, but I never quite saw that with him, and the ball didn't go in the basket for him. So, and it's just, Andrew Harrison has just been better than him, although Harrison is certainly one of the worst offensive players in basketball and, hasn't shot. I mean, he shot like 38% in college. So it's not like he's got some history of shooting the ball well, but he's at least pretty good defensively, which Baldwin wasn't. And then, the emergence of guys like Wayne Selden, we mentioned Harrison, and then Mario Chalmers actually coming back from the Achilles. He's looked pretty good in preseason. So I don't know that this is so much an indication of these guys being bad, which it is, but it's also an indication of, hey, we found cheaper, freer talent that's just outperformed these guys. And so regardless of pedigree, we're just going to keep them. They give us a better chance to win.
Along similar lines, the Utah Jazz kept swingman Royce O'Neal and waived Joel Ballenboy, who had this weird contract where his 2017-18 money guaranteed during last season. And they kept him around. I've had this lingering question of why Utah gave him so much money. He was a very late second round pick and he didn't make the team.
Well, I think the reason was that just in that environment, especially at a time when you didn't know how much, Dallas got screwed by this too with AJ Hammonds, right? That's part of why that trade to Miami happened, was because when you're giving guys the minimum, that was just such a small amount compared to where the cap was, and everyone had so much cap space. Then those minimums went way up and it actually became real money again, like it did for Hammonds. You're looking at $1.3 million for second year guys and almost $1.5 million for third year guys now. And that made those contracts a little more unpalatable. You felt like, hey, any second rounder, if we can get him on a 3-year deal, we might as well give him some guaranteed money, because money is cheap. But it stopped growing on trees, unfortunately, for a lot of these teams. And then O'Neal, I'm actually completely unfamiliar with him, looking to see. I think they felt with X amount, they need a little bit more depth on the wing, and they certainly have a surfeit of big guys there. What else we got here? Any other interesting waivers and keeps?
I don't think there were any other interesting waivers and keeps that I can think of. But the other thing we should talk about is the points of emphasis came out more formalized for NBA referees, and it was what we thought it would be: continuation, kind of seeing how they see the actions, and closeouts, which became a big point of concern during the playoffs.
Yeah, that had come out. Basically, the idea is that it doesn't sound, at least based on this, that it's really that bright line. It's just that the line is going to be changed to just emphasize, all right, did the guy really gather the ball before the contact occurred on continuation? And one of the other things is it says many of these plays will be deemed non-shooting fouls, primarily because, one, the shooter is bringing the ball upward after contact, or facing or lunging away from the basket, or both. And that's what it is, right? That's a legalese way of saying, hey, this is some bullshit shot that wasn't a real shot attempt. The guy's just throwing it up there to try and draw a foul. This isn't a shot the guy legitimately thought he had a chance of making out in the perimeter. So I am hopeful that they will enforce that pretty well and make those non-shooting fouls. And that during the Twitter NBA show, we will be right there to point it out in a rant if this is not enforced the way we would like it to be.
Disappointing that we're not doing the Clippers or the Rockets this week, but we'll see them in the future.
So we shall. Once again, also, we talked about this a little bit. The plan in Philly is for Markel Fultz to come off the bench to start the season. Brett Brown pointed to the fact that he didn't play much in the preseason. I really still hope that that's the only reason that he's coming off the bench to start with. But we'll see how he looks, and it may give Philly a little bit better balance to not have two pure rookies in the starting lineup to start with, but still a concern when your number one overall pick isn't starting for you. And that, I think, will do it. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about our sponsors today. Draft. It's not too late to join for fantasy basketball. What is the highest rated fantasy football app? Draft. Download the app anytime, search Draft in your app store and join a game in minutes, or play right from your computer on draft.com with their snake draft format. For limited time only, all new players get a free entry into a draft when you make your first deposit, but use my promo code CAPSPACE to make sure you do that, and of course let them know that you came from us. Play a real money game for free. Use that promo code CAPSPACE on your first deposit with the Draft app and draft.com.